The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Let's look at what's going on this week. Juliet Gash, senior reporter here at Today FM, and Michael Cogley, journalist at the Ireland edition of The Times, are with us. And I want to start, Juliet, with the latest actor who is now in an issue about his casting in a major production. J.K. Rowling, the author of Harry Potter, has been defending Johnny Depp. Why?
Yeah, so she's given him a role in the next movie, the Fantastic Beasts set of films that sort of are parallel movies to the whole Harry Potter franchise.
This is the sequel to the first Fantastic Beasts movie.
Exactly, yeah. So Johnny Depp has now been cast in the role of the villain Gellert Grindelwald, and so that's obviously a huge casting. Anything she touches turns to gold and will be box office, it's guaranteed. So people, initially when they heard Johnny Depp, were just not so happy. Lots of people weren't. And this stems from details that emerged from when he divorced Amber Heard. And she made claims, and they were in court, etc., that she was physically abused by Johnny Depp. She, you know, photos emerged in court of her with bruising. In the money she was given at the end of the divorce, she paid that immediately to a women's shelter because she had been the subject of being, people were describing her as a gold digger. People were saying that she was only in it for the money for the first. And people were even doubting, some commentators were doubting whether this had happened, whether the acrimony in the relationship had happened at all. Many diehard Johnny Depp fans, but I think she certainly silenced her naysayers when she did give away all the money. I think it was $7 million. And so people are questioning whether you should cast someone like that in what is essentially a children's film.
Okay, but hold on. He wasn't convicted of anything, was he? There were no criminal charges brought against him.
No, in the end, not.
And this, Michael Caldy, brings up an issue as to, you know, if there aren't criminal charges, and if there isn't a situation where there has been a conviction, does this mean that somebody should be blacklisted?
It's an interesting question, and it leaves people in a very, I suppose, confusing situation, especially producers and someone like J.K. Rowling, where she's come out and said not only is she happy to have him on board, but she's quite comfortable for him to be there and act in the latest movie, which again is targeted towards children and this kind of thing. So given that there was no criminal charges and stuff, and she's not a woman who's afraid to speak her mind at all, J.K. Rowling frequently speaks out about things that she finds wrong or offensive and that kind of thing, but this, and out of anyone to be best judged who would be a good fit for the role, surely it's her, and she seems to be quite comfortable with it, so I think she's probably right in the decision.
Possibly, but the thing is when's the last time Johnny Depp made a good movie? I mean, he has been
yeah, but hold on, if there was to be another Pirates of the Caribbean abomination, right, he would probably be still in it, wouldn't he, as Captain
Surely,
Jack Sparrow?
Yeah.
And would people object then, saying that they have to change Captain Jack Sparrow because suddenly
possibly.
Johnny Depp is
possibly,
unacceptable?
Yeah. But I genuinely don't understand from a casting perspective. He has been one character for the past however many years he's been doing Jack Sparrow, and then he did that horrendous Mordecai, which was one of the most appallingly expensive flops there has been. So why do people still consider, actually, do you know who we'll get? Johnny Depp.
Now, in fairness, doesn't J.K. Rowling have the right to make a decision for her own whether she thinks
second guessing her there, though.
But there's been plenty of others now who've had to step back from various positions. We've clearly seen Michael with Kevin Spacey.
Sure.
And again, no criminal convictions, but there is a whole lengthy charge sheet at this stage. Mm. And various others, and people say, would they watch movies involving any of these people? But does this mean an unofficial blacklist comes into place?
I presume it's dependent on the producer. I mean, if you take the case of Kevin Spacey, Netflix have certainly jumped the gun, just jumped at the opportunity to say, do you know what, no more Kevin Spacey, we're ruling him out from here on in. And that's a decision made entirely by the company. And those decisions predominantly aren't really made based on morals. I presume it's more, we're protecting our brand, we're getting rid of this, this is a toxic atmosphere, we don't need this on our hit show. And that's probably what happened with Spacey. So it's probably a decision that's made on a case-by-case basis, and who blacklists who is done on the production basis. So J.K. Rowling seems perfectly happy to have Depp on board.
Yeah, and so, Julia, would you boycott watching the new Fantastic Beasts movie when it comes out just because Johnny Depp is in it?
I don't think I'm necessarily the target audience, but I have not enjoyed a Johnny Depp movie since, like, Edward Scissorhands, so that's quite a time ago.
All right, let's move on. Who's the Fianna Fáil TD, Michael, who wants scramblers in schools to block mobile phone signals?
Well, this is a proposal examined at a meeting of party TDs yesterday, which included James Brown, Anne Rabbitt, James Lawless and Mary Butler, and they're talking about bringing in scramblers to block reception going into schools, which sounds so futuristic from when I was in secondary school anyway, back in the day. Like, if you were thinking that the teachers are going to start bringing
it's scrambler... It's not just secondary schools, it's primary schools as well.
Exactly. But of course, the age of, I suppose, going into digital use has dropped significantly as well. But they're talking about secondary schools, which I'd say would be so difficult to enforce. Can you imagine that kind of... It seems like an autocratic ruling over mobile phones, and the old bike shed now where people used to smoke is surely going to become where people will go down and use their phones instead when they're outside the building and the scramblers can't get them. So I think...
And they'd probably be joined by the teachers there who, of course, would be impacted upon as well by this.
Yeah.
I think the idea is a good one. It's a laudable idea to try to come up with some sort of plan. And in this case, they're looking at striking out online bullying. But the difficulty is, if you were able to scramble the signals, I think almost... The value would be for teachers to actually have kids not being able to use their phones so that they can concentrate in class. But the problem is that kids aren't being bullied only at school. It's when they go home. And that's what's so insidious about bullying online, is that you're followed home by your bullies. It doesn't just stop at 3:45 when the bell goes off.
But it's not just a bullying issue. I think it's a distraction issue.
It is, but I think the main thrust to this, and there was a digital bill that James Lawless introduced, and it is about, you know, internet giants having proper takedown policies and having, you know, measures that are concrete against bullying, because we're often told by Facebooks and Twitters that they do have policies, but when it comes down to it, it just takes one photo or one incident to go absolutely viral and ruin a child's life.
What do you think of this, and what's the possibilities? I can imagine, Michael, that the teachers' unions might have an issue if teachers found they weren't able to use their phones in their workplace.
Absolutely. Now, to be honest, I don't agree with the bill, but I think a probably simple workaround to that would be a teacher-friendly Wi-Fi or something like that. That, you know, that's the network that they can hop onto, and away they go, and the teachers...
There you have a solution already.
Exactly. But it's hard to tell, though. I think something like this, I think like an all-out ban is probably not the appropriate way to deal with people using phones. It's so unnatural.
Hang on, these are teenagers and children who are supposed to be concentrating. It's like a place of work when they're at school. They're supposed to be concentrating on what they're doing with their classmates and with their teacher. So why should they be on the phones under the table when they're supposed to be concentrating?
Well, you've lunchtime as well, so unless we have time-based scramblers that are going to come off at lunchtime and that kind of thing. But I remember back when I was in school, there was kind of... I think there was bans on camera phones for a while and all these various different things. And of course, now the internet is the new what the camera was onto the phone back then. So it's hard to know. I'm not really sure whether or not I think it's a good idea. I think I'd rather a bit more autonomy over my mobile device, and I brought it in, but definitely they are a distraction.
Okay. Juliet, history lesson from the week. Who was Christine Keeler, and why was her death marked by so many people this week?
Yeah, so Christine Keeler was a model in the 1960s, and she played a role that... she had an affair with a high-level politician, Tory politician.
He was a government minister, I think.
Indeed, yeah, John Profumo.
And he was the Minister for Defence, wasn't he?
Indeed. And so the difficulty was not just that a married cabinet minister was having an affair with a 19-year-old showgirl, but it was that she was also having an affair with a Russian diplomat.
And so, a diplomat probably meaning spy.
Exactly, yes. Right. That's the nice way of calling it. And so, so you're talking the height of the Cold War, and essentially he denied the affair at first, and he lied to Parliament about the affair, and then in the long run he had to step down. But his wife stayed with him throughout until her death, I think, and she stood by him. He kept his reputation going until that point. But unfortunately, Christine Keeler had she was, I suppose, targeted by tabloid media, and in fact she ended up having to go to prison because she was brought into a whole other element of sordid lying, because there was a tabloid editor who was a tabloid photographer rather, who was taking photos of her, and this got involved in some, there was a firebombing, etc. It was just an absolutely incredible story that they have made films out of, and they are about to make more.
One of the most iconic famous photographs of the 1960s involved her as well, Michael.
Yeah, it's a photo of her sitting naked backwards on a chair, as far as I understand. And again,
have you never seen that photograph? I know you're young, Michael, but you must have seen even in the last week.
Well,
that
my Cold War knowledge is not the strongest, but the story itself is just absolutely fantastic. It's like something that a Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. It's just real. It's an incredible story of both sides of the field being played, but not on an intelligence basis, you know.
Yeah, because you wonder, was there any ever proof that there was sort of pillow talk between Profumo, who was the minister concerned, and Christine Keeler, which she was then passing on to the Russian diplomat spy?
I imagine that's extremely hard to prove, but it seems very likely when you're talking to both parties involved.
Okay, let's move on to the prankster Uba Butler. What has he done, Julia?
this is, I don't know whether to love this story or absolutely hate it. So he's one of these pranksters, as you said, and he managed to get a fake restaurant to the number one TripAdvisor rating in London. Now, you're talking 18,000 restaurants in London that are on TripAdvisor, and he managed to get his fake restaurant, which was actually a shed in his garden in Dulwich, from 18,149th position on TripAdvisor to number one, which is some feat.
How?
Basically, I think he preyed on the idea that people, certainly in London and certainly a certain age group and type of person, hates the idea that they might be missing out on something. So he made it sound exclusive. He managed to get a shout out from Jay Rayner, who's a restaurant critic with the Times, or the Observer, I think, actually.
Who'd never visited the place,
no,
clearly.
No, indeed. So I don't quite know how that worked out. But he managed to get people to think that this was the place to be, with fake reviews that he was writing and that friends of his were writing. And then when people would ring, because it was by appointment only, because obviously the place didn't really exist, when people would ring up, he'd say, oh, I have a 6-week waiting list. And so he started taking names, and in a panic then was like, well, geez, there's so many names. Maybe I should start actually, you know, I'll feed a few of them. And he did. He took some people into his garden shed and fed them some Iceland food. I mean, at this stage, the game was up because he was only feeding his friends. But he managed to get to number one.
What does this say, Michael, about TripAdvisor and whether you should take anything on it seriously?
Well, I mean, the cynic in me would suggest maybe we shouldn't believe everything that's written on the internet, but it's
the comeback now from the newspaper sector. Yes, the revenge of the newspaper man.
First and foremost, I absolutely love this story. I think it's utterly hilarious and the best thing that's wrong with internet reviews, because you're relying on people who are totally anonymous. Like, this man got his restaurant, his shed, and like even the branding and everything. If you look at the photos he used, toilet cleaning products and bleach over it to make it look like appeasing food. It's just the levels he went to are simply incredible. And then on top of that, his previous profession was, he got paid a tenner to write fake reviews for other restaurants. This is, TripAdvisor came out and said, well, absolutely not. You know, most people are never going to do this. You know, for the most part, it's reliable. But this transcends across most reviews. I mean, if you look at IMDb when they're reviewing movies, the only people who goes on and reviews a movie that they absolutely hated or they absolutely loved. So you never get the middle ground of the catchment. So online reviews then become very, I suppose, convoluted and very uncertain, and whether or not they're trustworthy is another thing. And this kind of brings the whole thing to a new level, I think.
The thing is, as well, is in Dulwich is a super cool area in London, and it's, you know, it's, my sister lives very close to it, and in the past 10 years that area has gone from, you know, just a no-go zone to absolutely the hippest part of London. And so he's just next door to basically the coolest part of London, and he's got a shed and he's like, right, let's see what we can do.
Jack and Santry reminds us that there's a fantastic 80s song about Christine Keeler and the Profumo affair from the film Scandal, sung by Dusty Springfield and written by the Pet Shop Boys. There you go. Now let's move on. Donald Trump's eating habits. Michael Cogley from the Times Ireland edition. One of his former campaign managers, Corey Lewandowski, has revealed all. Tell us what Donald Trump used to eat on the campaign trail.
Well, he used to eat, his normal order from McDonald's would be 2 Big Macs, 2 fillet o' fish, which is what they're actually called, and a chocolate malted.
A high calorie content there, I'd imagine.
Absolutely, yeah. But the interesting thing about it was that he didn't eat the bread. So you kind of have to wonder, is this another one of his little quirks, or is he watching the weight, or why is he not eating
but
the bread?
He didn't apparently eat the bread on the Big Macs, but he ate it on the fillet of fish. So you're like, but also the fish is breaded. So either, like, you know, you're either doing it or you're not. Do you know what I mean?
But you know, apparently the reason why he eats so much food from McDonald's as well is that he believes it's the cleanest kitchens, because the stainless steel that they prepare
anytime
all the food in,
humans are making,
he's a germaphobe.
Kitchen. Anytime humans are making food in the kitchen, grub, dirty stuff can get in. So if you're a germaphobe, forget it.
But then you won't eat in that case,
yeah,
Juliet.
Exactly.
But this is his trade-off. Apparently they're the cleanest kitchens you will find in America if you're getting fast food.
Yeah, I don't know. And I mean, like, I'm not a big fast food fan anyway, but fast food in the States is a lot lesser quality than here. Like, it's quite grubby looking. It's much more dirty food than you get over here. I don't know. I just,
so you think somebody of his wealth would be able to afford
exactly.
maybe upmarket burgers and fish burgers?
Maybe, but he's also ordering a McDonald's that ends up on Air Force One. So I presume it's probably prepared to a relatively high standard, as McDonald's and Big Macs go. So they're probably a little bit better than what you get out of a normal branch if it's going on.
There's a whole niche of people who cook fake sort of Big Macs and fast food that they make healthy versions of. So, like, he can afford any kind of food he wants in the world, and he's
allegedly
eating this. Yeah, he's eating this drivel. But I mean, sure, he has a good enough food budget anyway.
There's another story from that same book, apparently, that he used to have his suits steamed for the next appearance while he was still wearing them. A woman had to come in, no, seriously, and they would steam iron his suits while he was wearing them.
Well, for a man who seems to be, who seems to spend a fortune on suits, whatever, there's something so wrong about the way he wears them. Like the tie way down below the, way down below the crotch, the waist up so high. Everything about the whole suit thing is so strange and wrong. And then if you look back at kind of footage from before, like back when he was a casino owner or setting up a casino down in Vegas and stuff, a lot more trim, a lot more into his stylings and stuff, but seems to have really just lost it entirely since he's taken the presidency.
Talking of food, I see now as well there's another kickback in with the theatres in London about people eating at shows, and this is a major issue I think for a lot of people. I mean, you buy going into cinemas food and drink, but can you hear it over the noise of people crunching?
I know, I think it's a shame that it's creeping into theatres, because you know, at least in a movie theatre you're dealing with a film, the actors aren't there, but when you go to
and
the theatre,
and it's also louder,
exactly, it's surround sound, etc., but you're dealing in the theatre with human beings who are projecting their voice without microphones, you know, and if you, they hear you chewing and, you know, like scratching your little crisp packets and all of that, it's very distracting. I've been there and it is really, really distracting. If someone is opening excruciatingly slowly a toffee out of that wrapper and they're just going as you're delivering this painful, poignant line, it just shouldn't be allowed there at all.
Yeah, I mean, this is coming from NIMAX theatres in the UK, and they're obviously sound testing the products, but my favourite line in the whole story is, they said, during a recent intense production, the actors are distracted by a front row couple who, quotes, were eating their way through a hamper. A hamper? Who brings a hamper of food to the theatre? It's insane.
You know, the theatre tends to take place after dinner. Do you know what I mean? Go and have a dinner and then go to the theatre.
Okay, we're going to play a little clip of Lily Allen and we'll explain why once we've heard it.
They're not being allowed into the country, so
are you
how
saying,
can I?
Are you saying you would do if they are allowed in, when they are allowed in?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'd have to go through the sort of bureaucratic side of it. I'm not going to do it illegally, but yeah, I mean, if there is a, you know, these children are being displaced, if they, of course, there's room for people in my house, I'm going to take them in. I think anyone would. Yeah. Like, if you're a parent, like, the idea of my children wandering around aimlessly without anywhere to go.
Now, Michael, that was Lily Allen saying she would welcome child refugees into her home. She did this after she visited the Calais jungle for the BBC. Tell us about the latest story involving Lily Allen and people in her home.
Well, minutes ago, I've just criticised the internet for not being the most reliable thing on the earth, but it does have some wonderful features, like dragging up something like that that happened a couple of years ago. Lily Allen is involved in a very bizarre dispute with her current tenants of a rented home in Queen's Park, just off Queen's Park Station in London, which she bought for just under $1 million back in 2008. She has a family of Italian diplomats living there who claim to have had a dreadful experience when the home that they were renting. Basically, Lily Allen tweeted that she couldn't get them out and that she herself would be homeless for Christmas because her tenants were claiming diplomatic immunity in order to avoid eviction. Now, the tenants themselves have disputed this quite separately, and they said that they were already on their way to move out and they seem very astonished and confused by what's going on.
Hang on, how would she have nowhere to go for Christmas? Lily Allen's worth a fortune. Wouldn't she be able to at least find a hotel room if it came to that?
You think so, but also she had the flat rented out, so it's not like she was, you know, in limbo while it was rented out. There was this 2-day period, not apparently until after Christmas, where she was tweeting saying she was going to be homeless with her children for Christmas. But they were like, no, we said we were moving out on a Monday, not the Friday, in that sort of 2-day period. But she's also saying that she's broke, despite the fact that she's worth apparently almost £15 million. And she's saying
can't be broke if you're worth 15 million.
Exactly.
Well, Lily Allen thinks so.
Yeah. Maybe she wants to be worth £40 million. But she's saying that no, you can't make that much money as a singer and that it hasn't been that lucrative lately and she doesn't have the money. But this family who were sucked into this Twitter spat are saying, listen, we won't have nothing to do with this. We're not famous people. We don't want the limelight and we're moving out anyway.
Thank you very much, Juliet Gash from our newsroom here in Today FM and Michael Cogley from the Times Ireland edition.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.